Welcome to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the monthly collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT and the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Library Center. Victoria Lautman's program this month features Eric Bogosian in an interview recorded earlier this week. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com, Let Them Take You Somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. Seminary Co-op bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores, the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, and one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend The Hindus, An Alternative History, by Wendy Doniger, published by Penguin Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring family properties, race, real estate, and the exploitation of black urban America by Beryl Satter, published by Metropolitan Books. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, and gifts. There, you're invited to discover The Library at Night, by Alberto Mangel, new in paperback from Yale University Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and at semcoop.com. Find out what people are thinking about and recommending at MavenChronicles.com. Maven Chronicles defines Maven as a trusted expert in a particular field who seeks to pass knowledge on to others. At Maven Chronicles, they passionately distribute advice and insight to all with links to monthly features, guest contributors, financial features, travel tips, and more. Visit often to see what the Mavens have to say at MavenChronicles.com, a proud supporter of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
Why, thank you. Thank you, and welcome to Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman here at the Harold Washington Library, of course, in our ongoing partnership with WFMT Radio. I want to thank MavenChronicles.com for underwriting this season. Also, I'd like to thank Seminary Co-op for schlepping the books here and remind everybody that you can go and hear all past five seasons of Writers on the Record at victorialoutman.com. And you know, Elizabeth Strout, who we featured a couple years ago, just won the Pulitzer Prize, Augustine Burroughs, Andrea Barrett, Anne Lamott, Russell Banks, Richard Price, on and on and on. And soon we will add Eric Bogosian to the lineup. Now, Eric Bogosian here, you might know him as Captain Danny Ross in Law & Order, Criminal Intent, or you might know him as a psychopathic genius alongside Steven Seagal in Under Siege 2. If you're lucky, you maybe experienced Bogosian's pioneering monologues from the 1980s, or saw him in either the staged or film version of his Pulitzer-nominated play, Talk Radio. If you're extremely alert, you might have noticed Bogosian in the credits of High Incident, a TV series he co-created with Steven Spielberg, or there's the album he collaborated on with Frank Zappa, Blood on the Canvas, or his voiced characters in the Beavis and Butthead movie. His two previous novels, the blog he wrote back when that term wasn't even invented yet. Oy, yes, Eric Bogosian is a creative omnivore, a kind of one-man cultural buffet whose output is mind-numbingly broad. His third novel is titled Perforated Heart, and it's thrilling to welcome Eric Bogosian to Writers on the Record. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Victoria. Thank you for that great introduction.
It was really hard to get it all in, and I thought, no, I can't leave
Frank. You missed a few things.
Yes, I know, in the buffet that is Eric Bogosian, but I had to leave something for the interview. But, you know, I realized that the last time I interviewed you here in Chicago was in 1998 when you were here with the Goodman Theater's production of Griller, and that Robert Falls directed. And I realized you actually have a fairly long history in Chicago. You went briefly to the University of Chicago, and I think that you actually performed here one of your plays at Name Gallery, which has been long defunct, in, yeah, like 1982 or something. So you go back to Chicago a long way, but it sounds like you, I would like to say you have a love-hate relationship. But after our conversation earlier, I decided it was more of a hate-hate relationship.
No. When I was a student here, and I was here for a couple years at Chicago, it was kind of a shock for me, the climate and the South Side. I'd never lived in a city before. And I left Chicago to go and work at I dropped out for a year, and then I ended up at Oberlin, where I was a theater major. But when I've returned to Chicago, I realized that I missed so much. Although I got to enjoy a lot of very Chicago things when I was here then. The blues scene and so forth was fantastic. But I've had a relationship with the Goodman that goes, and Bob, beyond Griller. I was here when Hurley Burley was being rehearsed here, and I loved that. And that was a very important play for me. And I've performed here at the Wellington, and I like the city very much. I had a great experience with Griller until the reviews came out, and I don't have a problem with Chicago. Just a critic or two.
Good. I wanted you to set the record straight, but we can go into how Chicago derailed your career, which is what you said later. But before we get into all that, the reason why you're here is because of your new novel, and I think it's really interesting that when you say Eric Bogosian to people, the reference points can be one of so many different things, some of what I just mentioned, that almost has to do with gender and age and where they are on the cultural spectrum. And these days, just even standing outside the library with you, people, you know, recognized you from being Danny Ross. But anybody who was even vaguely familiar with the New York avant-garde in, you know, the early 80s, you were one of the people who were present at the creation. And to a certain extent, that is what Perforated Heart is about. Yet, people really don't associate you yet so much with your novels, even though this is your third. It's interesting that you just quite haven't made the transition from the acting and the writing and the plays and theater to novelist, even though you're on your way.
Well, I've made the transition. I need the people to follow me on this transition.
You've made the transition.
And
I think
the nice thing about books is that they are artifacts that hang in there. So they're always available to go back and read them later if you find that you like my style of writing or the way I'm going at what I'm writing. I'm fairly eclectic, so it might be, you know, each book is very different, has a different feel to it. But I like books very much as a way of expressing myself, because with the advent of the internet, you can find your audience wherever they might be. And the books are permanent. And also what you present to the audience after you've done editing is really, you can stand behind it. You can say, unlike a play or a movie where you go, well, they didn't quite get that right, the director screwed it up, or the act, that's not the right actor for that role. What I put on the page is I stand behind it. And so that's, I like books for that reason.
Well, the two main characters in Perforated Heart are Richard Morris, circa 2005, and Richard Morris, again, circa 1976. The book really is about the 30-year difference between these two characters. And when the book opens, we meet the older Richard, who's, you know, a guy in his late 50s who has had a pretty great career as a novelist and writer, although he is as like a bitter and unhappy and unsatisfied as you can possibly be, alone, narcissistic. I mean, not at all like you. People keep saying, oh, it must be your alter ego. But it's somebody very different from you. And the Richard Morris that he ends up confronting is himself from 30 years earlier, at this moment when this guy at age 26 moves to New York and is just starting out in his career, wants everything that the older Richard Morris actually achieves. I thought that this was a fascinating way to approach a character, and it was interesting. I just was curious about what was it about this man at the two points in his life that made you decide this is the book I want to write now?
Well, it got triggered by what happens. The way he meets himself is that he finds his own journals from 30 years before when he's stuck in his house. He's been sick, and he's rummaging around. He's restless, and he finds these boxes of his journals, and he starts reading them. And at that point in the book, we've been following his journal, current journal, and then it flashes back to 30 years before the journal entries then, and it goes back and forth for the rest of the book. There's all kinds of structural things I had to figure out on how to make a book out of all of that, but it started when I had found my own journals. And at first, the first thing that sort of hit me when I read them was how naive I was, how ambitious I was, and how dumb I was. I mean, I was almost shocked by the pedestrian quality of my writing, and my thoughts on things were, there was nothing special about them, and I felt so special at that time. But the bigger issue, which really helped the book so much, is that a guy in his mid-20s is caught up in a very dramatic time in their life, especially if you've just shown up at a city and you've decided you want to break the ice there. Everything is laden with so much drama. Every date he goes on, I mean, if the girl blows him off, it's like he's going to be lonely for the rest of his life. If his new book doesn't work, if the editor doesn't like what he's writing, then he's going to be a failure. He doesn't know the way the story's going to end, the story of his own life. And so there's tremendous drama in this young man's life. The older Richard knows how the story's going to end, as we all do. And even in a bigger issue, I think I'm asking the question, am I the same person? Because you feel like, okay, I'm me now and I was me then, right? Am I the same guy? Well, I'm not. My play Talk Radio went on to Broadway 2 years ago. People said, well, how does it feel to have your play on Broadway? I said, it's not really my play. It's this guy who was, you know, 28, 29 who wrote that play.
When you say that you discovered your own diaries, how did that happen? I mean, in this book, Richard, the older, Richard Sr., I want to say, actually does have this heart surgery, and that's when he's forced to recuperate, and he sees these, and he ultimately ends up just burning them. Was it as big a surprise to you, or you just certainly were digging through stuff, and there they were, and you became as captivated as the older Richard does in these, where you just couldn't stop reading them and going through to the end?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was cleaning out something, and I found this carton with this period that covered from the end of high school through, just like this guy, through the period when I started achieving some kind of success and became too busy to keep them anymore, and didn't really resume any kind of journaling until the late 90s. So I did have this period of time where I was very busy or very drunk or something, where I didn't have the time to write my journals anymore. And when I read them, they were this daily list of my activities, some of which were just kind of generic, like, you know, drinking or going to nightclubs or something I saw on the street I had to write about. But there were also all kinds of notations of things that I had forgotten about, really heartbreaking experiences with girls or a friendship that I'd completely forgotten about or other events. And so I decided to tease this up into a book. Writing in journal style is a little challenging because, of course, I want somebody reading it believing that they're reading a real journal, but a real journal doesn't really read terribly well. So I had to give myself the conceit that the guy's a writer, so he's trying to write well throughout the book, believing that there's some sort of posterity that's going to find these and be so impressed, just like the letters that guys wrote in the 18th century or something. You know?
It's interesting, though, because the diary form is something which you have actually used before in some of your work. It's something that seems to be, well, because I guess you kept journals yourself, so maybe that was just an easy thing for you to access. But you've used that in earlier works of yours. And not only that, I read a reference when you even decided back in, I don't know, probably 1999, to start writing a novel, to write fiction. And you thought the way to do that is to write a journal entry every day for a person, and eventually you'll have like this whole series of experiences. So this form to you seems like it's really important to you in general, not just in your personal life, but in your creative life?
Well, it goes back early in that. The first book that I wrote was called Notes from Underground, and it goes back to more like the late 80s, early 90s. And it was, that was the decision that I made. And I would recommend it to any young writer if they're getting stuck on how to write a book, is make a journal entry every day for your character. Don't even worry about what's happening with the story. And then later, because editing is such a big part of my work, I spend as much time editing as writing, that then you go back and you say, okay, where's the story in this? I start with character always. So if I have a good sense of character, I can then say, well, what would this guy be writing about today? What would this guy be thinking about? I don't always write that way. My other two novels are written in third person and much more challenging, but also allow me to get much more descriptive, as normal novels do. I look a little askance at the proliferation of first-person writing that's out there today, whether it's fake first person or real first person or whatever. It's a little too easy, and I don't really like the confessional form. This book.
A little this, snip there.
I use that as the building blocks of the thing. It's very complicated structurally, and I had to spend a lot of time on how to introduce characters, bring them back later in time, switch them back and forth, and so forth.
You know, what you just said about the fake literature, and basically what you're talking about is a memoir, and the character of the older Richard does rant against that, like, endlessly, about the idea that this is going to be the death of literature, this fake literature, these memoirs, and so obviously there is some crossover in the way he thinks about things and the way you do, but it would have made a lot of sense at some point for you to have simply written a memoir of this really creative, vibrant period in New York that you lived, and it's interesting that you didn't feel that as a form that was valid.
Well, I don't think it's interesting enough, honestly. I just don't think that the whole thing is any kind of memoir form. I mean, the memoirs of Henry Kissinger, I want to read those. But the person who's going to write about, you know, how much fun they had in the 70s or celebrities they met or something, I just find that kind of not that interesting. So I wanted to use that as sort of, like I say, the bricks and mortar of my building, but it can't be the building itself. Definitely, that period was very exciting, and it's here in the book, and it was fun going back and dredging it up and saying, how can I make this sound interesting?
Well, I'd like you to read from the very start of the book, the very first entry of Perforated Heart is from December 12th, 2005, and this gives you a great idea of what Richard Morris became. And I know it's not you, and thank God it's not you.
It's the contemporary Richard Morris. And I just want to, I'm going to refer to something called the Humphrey, which is an award, which is the award ceremony he's at. There is no such award as the Humphrey. December 12th, 2005. Last night, Leon dangled the carrot of a fancy literary award before my greedy snout, and I, like the pig I am, lurched for it. Arrived on time for the Humphrey, freshly shaved in suit and tie, and joined the throng of hipster literati milling outside the ballroom. I was shown to a table near the back of the room. Not a good sign. An aging socialite, stinking of Chardonnay and Chanel No. 5, leaned in. "Are you a writer? I hope someone at this table is a writer." I beamed as if we were sharing a witty joke. A salad adorned with flower petals was put in front of me. Wine was poured. I spied Leon, seated three tables closer to the front of the room. He waved. I nodded. He turned away. My own editor could not be bothered to come over to my table and say hello. Of course, Leon wanted me there because he can't waste precious bucks promoting my new novel. No budget means there will be no display ads, no audiobook, no parties given in my honor at Balthazar or at the Four Seasons. All I will get is an abbreviated book tour, flying coach and residing at budget hotels, no NPR appearances, no magazine covers. If I'm lucky, I'll get two or three guest lecture gigs at second-rate colleges. It's all nickels and dimes to him. At my table for eight, the chocolate mousse lay unforked and the decaf cooled as the jovial movie stars on stage speculated on the names of the winners present in the crowd, forgetting to mention me, of course. An honorary award was given out to a publisher of progressive children's books. A eulogy was intoned for the CEO of a major media corporation who had died rock climbing a week earlier. And so the circus dragged on and on. Finally, a winner was announced. Upon hearing a name, not my name. My neighbors drop their eyes to inspect their silverware. At adjacent tables, heads turned to gauge my humiliation. An obese publicist to my right patted my hand in consolation. "I'm sure your book was much better, Richard." His pupils dilated with the thrill of witnessing my pain. The winner, a tweedy, aging Ivy Leaguer, florid-faced and wet-eyed due to the quarts of vintage wine he has consumed daily since his first literary bestseller, jogged up to the podium. The lickspittles leapt to their feet and applauded. With his usual tennis club jocularity, he snatched the prize from Catherine Zeta-Jones, took her in his arms, and kissed her on the mouth. I shivered with disgust.
Eric Bogosian. Reading from his new novel, his third novel, Perforated Heart. Actually, I said it wasn't you, but I take it back because I know that part of that actually is something that you must feel with your books. And I'm not trying to take pot shots at you, but you don't get the kind of recognition from your books that you have gotten from your other work. And so to a certain extent, maybe this does mimic some of your feeling about what it's like to be on the road. And I mean, Richard in this story takes, it really kind of rants against critics and stupid interviewers who haven't read his book and aren't saying nice things about it. And, I mean, I'd like to think that that wasn't your opinion since I'm interviewing you right now, but
It's not my opinion. I feel privileged to be not only writing and feeling pretty successful about it, but getting published, which in the realm of books is that in itself is a big accomplishment. I did make a big shift from being a playwright I do write plays still, but to giving a lot of attention to the books. This is Richard's point of view, and as you know from interviewing so many authors, there are the guys at the very top who seem more bitter than anybody, but they are the guys at the top. There's no question. They won the big prizes and they're big bestsellers. There's people who never get published. But in the world of literary writing, of literary fiction, there's actually many, many, many people who are sitting sort of in the middle. They sold something, and it sold a lot of copies once, and now it's not doing so well, and they continue to slog along. The literary world is not so easy right now. The books aren't selling as fast as they once did, and they don't really know what to make of it, and they do get bitter. Perhaps they're teaching somewhere or whatever they're doing at the moment, but it's not like you know, one thing about books is you can be in that middle place like in the acting world and you can be making a ton of money. And at least you've got your house with the swimming pool to go home to. But writers don't have that. They are nobody's making a lot of, I don't know who's making a lot of money. Somebody who's writing children's books or fantasy novels or crime novels. Those are the guys making a lot of money. This stuff is not, this is something that you do because you have to do it and you love it.
Well, the Richard in 1977, who starts out in Manhattan and he's living in this just terrible arrangement with two roommates who are sharing a room, and he's living in the living room, Chaim and Dagmar. I mean, it's just, you know, every story that you hear about, you know, like trying to live a life in New York before it was even really expensive. But the thing that was amazing, and this is what you lived, are his references to, the Chelsea Hotel and Robert Wilson, and gee, they just opened this new place, the Mud Club and CBGB's. It's right at the moment when, I mean, there was a real avant-garde in New York that, like, now doesn't exist in the same form. It was at the moment that so many things crystallized, and the moment when Eric Bogosian first began to, create monologues and was reading at various places in the downtown scene. And I think that as a cultural kind of roadmap, because that stuff that you wrote is all true. Everything that young Richard is writing about occurred. Those people exist. You probably shared those exact memories. Maybe that was stuff that you dug up in your own diaries. I mean, was it taking you back down a memory lane that you had sort of forgotten about?
I just felt I had this huge reservoir of experiences of what was a really exciting time. I came to New York when, everybody remembers the headline, Ford to New York, Drop Dead. Well, that's when I got to New York. As far as everyone was concerned, the city was finished. It was done, and people were getting out of there as fast as they could. The city was in really bad shape, And I arrived, and I'm, I think, 24, and I thought it was the coolest place. It was full of mystery. Every doorway held a different secret behind it. There were so many things to watch. Crime was washing over the city, but I felt kind of invulnerable, and I loved watching all the kind of netherworld and demimonde people who populated the city, and you never knew what you were going to get into. It seemed limitless. And then, at the same time, being a person involved in the arts, I ended up leaving the theater world and getting involved with the visual art, a whole gaggle of visual arts people, who some of whom have become very, very successful. But really, the shift was huge for me, because I'm a theater guy. I think like a theater guy. They're thinking like visual artists. They were very exciting to be around, these guys, Robert Longo and Cindy Sherman and all these guys. And we were this huge gaggle of friends who, ironically, as this book is coming out, the Metropolitan Museum of Art is doing a show right now called The Pictures Generation. And if you looked at the list of all the artists in that show, that's the list of all of my friends from 1978. They were a fun bunch of people. So I got swept up in just tremendous activity and fun. And I did want to try and use my mind as a kind of a time machine and go back and say, see if you could, how much you can remember about this disco or this club or this coffee shop, and lay it out there, because it's all gone.
Well, you were also, young Richard was remembering, part of the fun and excitement was major drug intake, major carnality.
Major.
I mean, it was hard for me to actually find stuff for him to read that didn't refer to, you know, some wild sexcapade or, you know, and very naive and kind of edgy stuff. Yeah. Turn to page 52 and you'll read it. It made me realize what a different world it was then, because this is a guy who's like, well, you know, I tried cocaine today, and, you know, it's really great. It's like medicine. It keeps you writing. There's nothing addictive or bad about it. And then he sniffs heroin, and he thinks that's even better. Creative people can take heroin because it's not going to do anything bad to them. And, I mean, he is so naive and, as you say, stupid, that you wonder how he even survives that period. And well, here you are to talk about it.
I do wonder, and some people didn't survive. There's one guy who's mentioned. I have all kinds of cues and references in the book that are my own little secret references and cues that I could footnote the whole book, and I could say, this is what I'm talking about here, or this is what I'm talking about here. But there's one guy named by name in the book, Bobby Battery, who was a young punk rocker who I hung with then. He died at 23 of a heroin overdose, so you know, he'd be in his 50s today. And it was there was a tremendous dynamism. The sexuality of the time was also, it just happens to be that I landed in New York in 75, exactly between 71, the advent of the pill, and 81, when AIDS really became everybody's concern. And those 5 years before 80, it was a time of great license. And I want to say, too, that after AIDS and other STDs infected the whole city and the whole way everybody was living, there has been a kind of a sense that, you know, people were doing something wrong. Maybe they were getting too far out there. But at the time, no one was thinking that. People were thinking, this feels good. This is a time of great freedom. And also, we were in our 20s. I mean, if we all died at 28 years old, there'd be all sorts of things we could do and never worry about the, you know, what happens, because you could all smoke cigarettes to your heart's content because you wouldn't live long enough to have the repercussions. So there was this freedom, and in our minds it fit in with the arts, and it all was part of that, and we were definitely, and that was part of it. I don't know if it actually contributed to us being better or worse artists. We were very motivated. There were lots of us. The rent was cheap, and I feel fortunate, yay, that I lived through it, and that I lived it, and I lived through it.
There are a number of really great recurring characters, but I think that my favorite was this fellow Big John, who is a stop moving that microphone. I saw
I'm
you
trying
do
to
that.
Get this just
<You're>
right.
Just he is a drug peddler. He's like supplies these crazy drugs to the young Richard, but he also is like this autodidact know-it-all about everything, and the kind of digressions that this John goes on sometimes go on for four pages, and they will move from the castrati in Italy to medical practices in the 19th century to, I mean, just like incredible, long-winded but fascinating little digressions. And so I don't know if that was a real character, but just how you even came up with their, they're like monologues. They're the, like the kind of monologues that one would hear you doing in the 80s.
I have not told anybody where that stuff's come from, but I'll tell you now where it came from. I promise not to tell anyone. I've known guys like this. I've always been fascinated by men like this who seem to be stay bombed all the time, but they know everything about everything. And they do whatever they want to do and often have a very sexy girlfriend, which John has in the book. So these guys, are, especially when I was young, I mean, this is the guy I want to be when I grow up. This is a guy, I'm from the theater, it's Falstaff. I mean, there's no question. This is the guy who has this appetite, and the young Hal is very impressed with this guy, but eventually leaves him behind. In fact, this same sort of character showed up in a famous Chicago novel, Humboldt's Gift by Saul Bellow. Humboldt was also that type of guy, and the young writer in that book reveres this guy, but actually goes past him as a very careeristic guy, which happens here in my book too. I wasn't imitating Humboldt, it just sort of was a coincidence. But I'll tell you where it came, but the things that John talks about, I love this idea of the huge game of a million ideas that are all interconnected, but in a very spacey way. And actually where that comes from is it must be 7 or 8 years ago. I'm always getting these things where people ask me for reference for Guggenheim Fellowship. And I finally said, what is a Guggenheim Fellowship? And so I looked it up, and it's for mid-career artists who need to go more deeper into what they did. So I said, I'm going to apply for a Guggenheim Fellowship. And all I wrote in my application was, I want to stop writing TV shows, and I want to just do my work. I don't feel like supporting myself anymore. I want to give me a breather here. So I got the fellowship, and I spent the year reading, if any of you are into the New York Review of Books, I read every issue of the New York Review of Books I could find, and every single arcane reference that I could find in that book, in those issues, I looked up and researched and found out everything about everything that was just historical or odd facts or anything I could find. And then I kept tons of notes on this stuff, and eventually boiled them down to these monologues of John's that cover, like you say, the Zen. One of my favorites is the perfect way to behead somebody. The Zen art of beheading, which the Zen monks would teach the samurai, teach some of the officers during World War II how to hold it, get that head off just perfectly. Kind of interesting. The world is a big place, and I think for the writer, young writer, this was all part of how big the world was for him.
Well, the Guggenheim should be proud of how you used that.
Yeah, I had to write a report at the end of it.
In the meanwhile, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Don't go away. Thank you.
I dropped my book.
This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago and our monthly broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. This interview was recorded earlier this week at the Harold Washington Library in the Cindy Pritzker Auditorium. This broadcast is made possible in part by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and by MavenChronicles.com. Find out what people are thinking about and recommending at MavenChronicles.com. Maven Chronicles defines Maven as a trusted expert in a particular field who seeks to pass knowledge on to others. At Maven Chronicles, they passionately distribute advice and insight to all with links to monthly features, guest contributors, financial features, travel tips, and more. Visit often to see what the Mavens have to say at MavenChronicles.com, a proud supporter of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
Welcome back to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. I want to just remind people that coming up next month, we have Monica Ali, who's going to be here June 18th. And then we take a little hiatus for 2 months to rest. And then we'll be back in September with our 6th season. Richard Russo will be here with his new book, Sherman Alexie, in October, and Audrey Niffenegger with her new novel in November. But we are talking today with Eric Bogosian and his third novel, Perforated Heart. what happens to Big Richard in this book is he becomes so caught up with young Richard and the people that were so important in his life. I mean, they were his family. In fact, his own family he just turns his back on and doesn't know how to deal with his own feelings for his dying and then dead mother and his father, who's like in his dotage. And the parental relationships are not good. But Big Richard decides he's going to go and track down his past and find the people that were so important to him. And this could have gone any number of ways. It could have gone into something great, or it could have gone into something not, well, hellish. It's sort of in between. And the idea that you go back, return to your past, look at all those things, and this is just depressing. I mean, everybody is just, oh, one's back in Israel and just an old, weazened guy, and the woman he was halfway crazy for, Dagmara, is back in Poland, and she just hates him and accuses him of rape. And basically the idea here is just leave the past alone. Don't go back to your past.
Well, if you're Richard, you should do that, because Richard has a very selective memory. He doesn't remember the wrongs that he committed with these people because he is such a narcissist. But that isn't really where it ends, because that would be just a story of a very selfish guy. But he makes the case passionately throughout the book that the only way for him to really be an artist is to be this way. And in the most blatant or easy to understand form of this, had he, and this comes up with a couple of women that he has relationships with, if he gives in to their need for domesticity, then he's going to lose, it's like you know, Hercules getting his hair cut or something, he's going to lose what his strength as an artist. So he feels that his ultimate priority is writing. That's the way he looks at it, and that if he ever develops, he doesn't say this exactly, but if he ever develops healthy relationships with people, he will become all kind of loose and soft, and he won't be the guy that he is. I don't know if this is some writer's exact way of looking at things, but what I've learned just through biographies and things of certain writers, some very, very venerable and great writers, is that they have a sort of commitment like this. Roth, Naipaul, these guys have made it pretty clear that their first priority is getting that work done. Now, in my own life, I work all the time, but I also have raised two kids, and I'm a dad, very involved with my children who are grown now.
Well, you've been married for like practically 30 years,
right?
So
that's my life, and I sometimes wonder, you know, if I had more time to polish and write, would I? I don't know. Is there something I'm not doing that I need to do? But honestly, I'll be really honest here. I was doing a lot of drugs in the old days. I stopped, and I always think that kids are more healthy than drugs. Whatever time I'm spending with my kids, I could be bombed out on heroin and falling over or drunk in a bar somewhere. So I'm not doing that. So I'll allow myself the time to play ball with my kids in the backyard. It's probably healthier.
Well, I'm glad that you're getting all of this out on the page rather than in your own life. And I'm sure your wife, Jo Bonney, who you, in a very romantic and successful whim, married after knowing her for 6 weeks, and it stuck, which is kind of amazing. And she became really like almost your collaborator, your director on so many of your really important work. And
yes,
you still seem to have a wonderful kind of creative energy that most people can't boast of.
It's a tremendous luxury that we have a life where we talk about our work with each other, and I love that. It's, you know, we some mornings I'm sitting there and we're, you know, over coffee half awake, but we're actually discussing aesthetics, and I like this. This is the life I wanted to lead, and I'm leading it. Jo is an amazing person. She's Australian. I really wonder what sort of forces of the world had to be in play to find this person from 30,000 miles away and have her cross my path, and we ended up working together and living and having a life together.
You have kind of the best of both worlds, so I realize, because everybody thinks you're like this bad boy, and they will read this book and think, oh, well, this is, I've read reviews of it that are basically saying, well, yeah, this is, yeah, we're really getting the real stuff. This is Eric Bogosian and, you know, catting around and drugs and wild women wanting sex. And yeah, you've been married for 30 years to one woman, and you've got these great boys who are in college and brainiacs. And so it's great that people actually think you're one way, but you're not. I'd like to get
no
that.
No comment.
Okay, I want you to read a little bit from the young Richard because he takes up half the book, and because his moments where he's really just what you were talking about at ground zero of the creative avant-garde. There's this entry from May 12th, 1977, when he is at St. Mark's Church, which is the place that you actually first, I think, started doing your work in New York, one of them very early on. And so here again, we're getting a little bit of look into maybe your past, but certainly the avant-garde past in New York.
And we should make the warning that this is the one of the few parts of the book that are not pornographic.
It was hard to find. I had to read the book twice.
Drugs and
right.
Wanting
sex.
For this radio thing here.
It's very clean, but it's interesting.
It's very clean. May 12, 1977, gave a reading of my story, My Lucky Day, with a bunch of new writers at the St. Mark's Church Poetry Project. This is a famous place. Allen Ginsberg reads there, also Patti Smith, who is this amazing new poet. Didn't pay much attention to what the other people were reading, except this one skinny guy, Jim Carroll, who was pretty cool. He's famous for being a heroin addict. Most of them just seemed stoned. I was fifth on the bill. As soon as I stepped up to the podium, I could see that no one had ever heard of me, didn't know me at all, and so they weren't going to like what I read, no matter how well written it was. Overall, I'd say that what I read was mostly misunderstood. On the other hand, I actually got up there and I did it. I give myself that credit. I transferred the story from an idea to a tape recording of the junkie to writing it all down to actually producing a written piece. Something I originated as a concept became something that existed within the coordinates of time and space out there in the world. This is the beginning. Even if no one got what I was doing, I get what I'm doing. Afterward, went out with Dagmara, that's his roommate, and some friends of hers she had dragged along to my reading. We took over a booth at one of the Slavic restaurants over on 2nd Avenue. Dagmara ordered in Polish. Her friends were incredibly square girls, all giggly and weird. As a group, they had a certain appeal, but individually they fell flat. Each one had a defect of some sort. One was too heavy, one had horribly pale skin, like she was dying. I drank two bottles of beer while they devoured Polish sausage and pierogies. The beer loosened me up, and I flirted with the almost pretty one, but then Dag shot me the gypsy evil eye, and I realized no way was I going to pull that off. Worst of all, I don't think they got my writing at all. They kept saying how funny it was, but they also agreed that it was quote-unquote depressing and quote-unquote negative. On the other hand, they fell in love with some coy crap that this overweight, incredibly homely poet wrote. Vito Acconci, by the way, that's who I'm describing there. He was describing the hair on his stomach, and they loved that. I ended up taking the subway uptown with Dagmara. It's hard to go home with someone who you're not actually sleeping with, especially after a big night and a couple of beers. Haim wasn't there when we got home, so we started fooling around in the kitchen, but she stopped me when I slipped my hand under her cashmere sweater and fondled her brassiered breasts. She has this weird Eastern European Catholic mystery about her. She brought out a bottle of port wine. We got real drunk, and I woke up around 3 a.m. Dagmara had already gone to bed. No idea where Haim was. I split the apartment and trooped across Central Park. I sat on a bench in the dark for almost an hour, watching anonymous figures moving through the glow of the old-fashioned street lamps. I realized that I need a level of intensity beyond anything that's in my life right now. I need to get as close to madness as I can. I thought, this is my life, right now. Sometimes I'm so alone.
You know, it's curious knowing you in all these different ways as the writer, as the performer, as the playwright, as voices on Beavis and Butthead, and I particularly loved your role as the crazed maniac in Under Siege, but I'm curious about how you are able to so fluidly move through all of those things. I mean, you're still you've got this, you know, really substantial starring role on Law and Order, and you're still writing books, and so those are overlapping. And is it really so easy for you to so seamlessly move between these, or do you find that you have to really, you know, you're focused on one thing and then you have to focus very closely on something else, and there's no overlap in your mind in these things?
I actually need to be distracted in order to work. So something like having Law and Order and the lines I have to learn and showing up on set helps me write, because if I just had all day free to write, I probably wouldn't get anything done at all. I somehow, for some reason, this is the way it works with me. It all starts from the same place. It all starts with character and a certain need to fantasize and transcend who I am. I think that's why I want to play characters or live in the realms of the characters as I'm writing. I used to think when I first started acting that the applause was why I did it. Later, I thought the kudos or even the money and the attention and the fame had something to do with it. But really, it's about the magic of becoming somebody else. And I love doing that. And I get to do it with the books as well. I go off in another place, and I find it magical to be able to enter another person and live that person's life, often or usually or always, without consequence. I also really need to be engaged. If the Guggenheim taught me one thing, it gave me a year off, and I found that I don't want a year off. I want to be always in some sort of struggle with my life and with my work. It's just where I'm most happy. And those two things, engagement and transcendence of my being, it seemed to be what I want to do. But I'm always shifting. I mean, I have a part of me that, well, I'll put it this way. 4 years ago, I was completely immersed in yoga and Anusara yoga, and I was pretty serious about it and practicing it almost every day, meditating and doing that. Now I'm more fully, deeply involved in cigarette smoking and Texas Hold'em. So,
and you're a happier person.
And I'm much happier. And I just don't have an answer. I think life has to just keep flowing in these dynamics back and forth. I'll never be happy as one thing.
You're at Smorgasbord. If anybody's interested in asking a question, this would be a good time to step over your neighbor and approach one of the two microphones in the last 15 minutes here. One of the things I really enjoyed was going to your website and reading every single, I can't believe I did this, blog entry that you wrote starting in 1994, like the year after the World Wide Web even was invented. And it is the most personal kind of insight into you and it really is like the true version of this book. I mean, you stop doing it at a certain point, and there are not that many of them, but it's just really almost these brilliant kind of stream of consciousness things about what it means to be an artist. A lot of the stuff that Richard actually says in the book, but true, things that you actually lived, and talking about your experiences shooting certain movies with Adam McGoyan, or when you were working with Oliver Stone on the version of Talk Radio that you wrote and then starred in for his movie. And there was a very funny thing in there about how he just hated your first couple of takes of that movie. And he had to just like, and he told you he hated them, and he had to start over. And a lot of sort of things that you say about what it's like to actually work in Hollywood and basically how hateful it is. And you thought that was going to launch you into another realm of like major movie star. And you said that some of the people out there were telling you had to change your name, you have to get a nose job, you've got to cut your hair, you got to, you know, not be Armenian anymore. And so I'm not sure where my question is in here. It's almost like there was a path at one point that could have gone somewhere else for you. And I wondered, were you disappointed by that you didn't become like Eric Bogosian, the movie star, even though you would have had to basically sign a deal with the devil to do it?
I came to an understanding, I don't know when I did, that there's a difference between my fantasies and their use to me and what I really want to be doing in my life. There was no question that in the right around after Talk Radio came out, I had opportunities to go and become involved in Hollywood on a level that I chose not to, because I had small children at home and I didn't want to be away all the time. It's impossible to be in two places at the same time. You have to decide, what are you going to do? Fish or cut bait? And the decisions that were made, all the forks in the road that I took, I have no regrets about, and I'm actually very, very happy with where I ended up. I don't know to what degree people can really make these choices in their life. So many things are outside one's control. But I did fantasize, and I'll admit it. And I don't know what would have happened. I mean, there were turning points that were so odd. I had a show, Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll, which was a solo show, and it did really well. It was a huge hit in New York. HBO bought the rights to put that show on HBO. But at the time, that was when they were first doing the breaking comics type of stuff. We, in our wisdom, decided that we would make a much more a better deal for me with a movie company that would then film it. And they did. They made a film of it. And that film, that company went out of business as the film was being released. And the film was lost into a realm of lawsuits and all sorts of things, and very few people got to see it. If it had been on HBO, I would have been doing stadiums after that, and my life would have been different, and I'd probably be dead of a cocaine overdose by now.
And not
so thank God that
us.
Didn't happen.
We have a couple questions here. Thank you.
Yes. What do you see as being the big differences between performing your own work on stage and performing the work of others? And is there something that's freeing and enjoyable about performing other people's work on stage?
Well, there's another big difference, and that is the stuff that I've done of my own has been almost exclusively monologue work, and I'm not in dialogue with anybody, so I don't have to really listen to anybody else. So that alone is very freeing. And then I can rewrite as I go along because there's no structure that has to be adhered to. So that's a lot of fun. But I really like being an ensemble. I have not been in many shows since college on stage. The one that was most memorable was Stephen Adler Gierges's the Judas play. I just call it the Judas play. I played Satan in that play, and it was a lot of fun. And I got to work with all my compatriots at the Labyrinth Theater, and Phil Hoffman directed, and it was to have to work with people was fantastic. I love being on stage in plays with other people. The difference they're apples and oranges. I don't like really writing for myself. I prefer writing for other people, and when I'm acting, I prefer to have other people be writing for me and just learn the lines and figure out the rest. You're welcome.
Another question?
Hey, before you differentiated between like an actor's way of thinking and a visual artist's way of thinking, and I was wondering how hanging out with all these visual artists and their way of thinking, whatever you understand or imagine that to be, might have influenced your practice as an actor and writer.
The biggest one that comes to mind, the difference between the visual artist gang that I hung around with and the theater people I had been around before and since, is that visual artists think in terms of look and style, and they dress better and they're more fun, and they're always looking out for what's going on, and they don't care at all about theater. I ultimately ended up making theater for these people. They knew no rules of the theater. They knew no way about the way it should be done or shouldn't be done, or unities or accents should be done exactly this way. They just knew what they liked and didn't like, and it really shaped my work a lot during that time. Theater people are much more earnest and often are not keeping track of what's going on the cutting edge of the culture. I hate to say it, but that's kind of the case. I don't know why that is. There's also one really, really big difference, and it was one of the reasons why Soho attracted me in the late 70s. Artists get up in the morning and make work, and they make the work they want to make. Theater people, if you're an actor, you have to wait until somebody calls you to say they want you to be in their play. And very often you're not even thinking about that play. And then all of a sudden the most important thing in your life is whether or not you're going to get cast in Our Town or something. And you weren't even thinking about Our Town a week before. And that's kind of strange. I don't like that being whipped around like that by other people's agendas. I like this idea of... And it was why I was attracted to theater artists like Richard Foreman, who had their own agenda, and they would get up and they would make the work they wanted to make.
You mentioned that you are very eclectic and so many things in your head at one time. Are you thinking of two or three novels at one time, or do you already have your next one in your head while you're halfway through writing this one?
I am trying to think of different things to do at the same time? In fact, you're reading my mind, because that's what I was doing last night as I was falling asleep. I was trying to think of a quick book to write while I'm researching my next book, which is about some events that happened after the Armenian Genocide in Turkey after in the 1920s. But I've begun to realize these are things I've learned as a writer over the years, that when I come up with 6 different projects to do at the same time, often I'm trying to get myself off the hook of the hard one that's right in front of me. I do like to be distracted by some profession. You know, somebody else has something else I'm doing, Law and Order, but I need to stick to this project about the Armenian Genocide now. It's hard, and I will. That's something I can do as a sort of a grown up that I couldn't do when I was younger.
One thing we didn't touch on, which I'd like to do before we go, because it's actually sort of rude for me to bring it up now, and if I brought it up earlier, you might not have wanted to be so honest and open with me, and that is that you said somewhere that the whole process of writing a novel to you really began when you felt the doors were closing to you in the theater, that the kinds of work that you were writing and wanted to get produced, that the whole, you know, terrain of theater had changed so much that you simply couldn't do and get things produced the way you wanted. And so really you came to this type of work maybe not from just always thinking, gee, I can't wait to write a novel, but because it was another outlet for you, because the outlet that you wanted wasn't as available. Is that so?
Yeah, it's 6 of one and a half a dozen of the other. There was, I was very busy and very successful in the theater from the late 80s through about 1998, when I brought my play Griller here to Chicago, to the Goodman Theater. The unbelievably vicious response I got to this play, I don't understand. I knew
only
the play,
from one person, I'd like to point that out.
But I mean, the play needed work. There's no question about that. I understand that. But I don't understand critics who write as if you've just spent 2 years of your life writing something just to upset them. That's actually not why I work. I don't work to upset, what's her name?
I'm not saying it.
Okay. Well, never mind
about
her name.
She's still working.
But she, you know, she really went after me hammer and tongs, and as a result, the biggest project I'd ever worked on came to a grinding halt, and things started to really slow down for me. But I want to say that it's not just about that. I've continued to write theater plays and been produced since that time, not always the way I want to be produced, but I get produced. All the plays I've written since then, and about 4 or 5, have been produced. But there's also the nature of the theater. The theater is very much in the nonprofit world. It dances to the tune of the subscription audience, which is a very particular, affluent, older audience that has their own particular needs. And I can't always find the people. It happens at 8 o'clock. You have to be there. You have to have a huge amount of money in your pocket to go to see that thing. The internet really changed the way things work for books. And I saw in the 90s, a new generation of writers coming up who were stretching out and writing in a very different way than the guys we were thinking of as the sort of Mount Rushmore of the American literary scene, the Roths, Updikes, and so forth. Those guys were kind of old-fashioned in a way. I love their writing. But these new guys, David Foster Wallace and Dave Eggers and others, were writing, and I felt they were really writing from their heart. They were writing in a very expansive way, and they were finding an audience that could find them anytime they wanted on the internet and order their books instantly. And I wanted to be able to write from that center to an audience that's interested in what I'm interested in. My interests are not congruent with the average subscription audience member who's mainly interested in I don't know what, the cleaning their Lexus or something. It's not my priority in my life, and I have other things that I need to think about, and that's what I want to write my books about.
Well, in the meanwhile, if anybody is in New York, I think it's the first week in June, like June 2nd or 3rd, you are doing, I mean, because nobody gets to hear you do your monologues anymore, and you are still connected with the Labyrinth Theater, and you every year do this incredible, what they call Bitter Honey fundraiser, where you go back into your archives and perform monologues. What a great opportunity. If anybody's going to New York, get a ticket to that thing, because like we just don't, you're not going to ever do those again. I mean, that's it. It's
done. It's fun. It's fun to do them. I've been rehearsing them in my hotel room while I've been traveling, and it's kind of terrible, but I laugh so much at my own writing. I like it so much. So I'm just having a great old time at me and my characters in my hotel room.
And the last thing I want to point out is this book, Perforated Heart, has won awards for its cover design. But the thing that people don't realize is when you take off the cover, and I hope you get a copy of it, and it's got this beautiful foil cover of a heart, underneath it is actually what the young Eric's journal would look like. And it's just this treat. And how many people actually open up, take the cover off their book? Very few. So when you get a copy, look at that, because it's really exceptional. And we've unfortunately run out of time, but it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Eric Boghossian.
Thanks, Victoria.
I really appreciate your being here. And when you do the Armenian book or anything else, you've got a forum right here on Writers on the Record.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all for joining us today. See you next month. You've been listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Loudon. Yay!
The people at Maven Chronicles and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Our special thanks to everyone associated with the series at the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Library Center, including Commissioner Mary Dempsey. Engineers for the broadcast are Eric Arunas and Leland Mosley. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer is Victoria Lautman. Broadcasts of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman are made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere. And by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Seminary Co-op Bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually 3 Chicago bookstores, the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, and one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend The Hindus, an Alternative History by Wendy Doniger, published by Penguin Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring family properties, race, real estate, and the exploitation of Black urban America by Beryl Satter, published by Metropolitan Books. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, and gifts. There, you're invited to discover The Library at Night by Alberto Mangel, new in paperback from Yale University Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and at semcoop.com.